will begin today by holding a, by opening a work session on Senate Bill 573. Council.
Thank you, Chair Brodick and members of the committee. Senate Bill 573 is here for work session. It relates to pedestrians and traffic violations. Present ORS 811.028 creates a Class B traffic violation for drivers who fail to stop and remain stopped for pedestrians. Presently, the offense covers failing to stop and remain stopped for pedestrians in certain situations that the statute spells out specifically. What's important about Senate Bill 573 is that it adds a new element to the offense of failing to stop for a pedestrian. And the idea of the bill is to allow a pedestrian to stop traffic without actually having to step into the road. And this is accomplished by the pedestrian being right ready to enter the street and using a hand gesture. The amendment that is significant to Senate Bill 573 is the Dash 3 Amendment. And I'll quote the language from the Dash 3 Amendment. This encompasses the new provision. The driver of a vehicle commits the offense of failure to stop and remain stopped for a pedestrian if the driver does not stop and remain stopped for a pedestrian when the pedestrian is waiting on the curb or shoulder of the highway at a crosswalk and raising a hand and arm toward oncoming traffic.
Okay, and this amendment was made because in a rare moment of agreement, Senator Beyer and I agreed that there was some clarity problems with the initial draft where it was unclear what a driver could really be expected to watch for. So we deleted that problematic language, which Senator Beyer on the original bill was on line 11. That language has been deleted. And we have Scott Bricker in the audience today if we need any assistance on this.
Are we still, Madam Chair, using the hailing the taxi cab sort of issue?
Yes, it's fairly specific. The waiting on the curb, raising a hand and arm toward oncoming traffic. Are you watching Court of Appeals?
It's funny because I walk home a lot at night. I live right across the street, and at night it's very dark. And I stepped out from the curb, and there was a lot of traffic, and they didn't see me, and no one would stop. Yeah. So I stepped out a little bit further, and then they saw me and stopped. But it was made me nervous the whole time I was walking across the street.
It's very nerve-wracking, and
I'm not sure.
Oftentimes, as both a pedestrian and a driver, I want to do the right thing, but someone's standing on the curb kind of looking hopeful, so I don't know whether they're hopeful about the Starbucks coffee they're likely to drink or whether they actually want to cross the street because they're standing on the curb where they're safer. And it would be nice to have clarity for both the driver and the pedestrian as to when they wanted the clarity along with safety as to when they wanted the traffic to stop.
We're going to have to reteach all these school children.
That's right. Well, and we also need to make sure that people understand that, the car actually has to stop before you better run out in front of them. So this just gives the pedestrian a mechanism to get the car to stop short of actually appearing in the crosswalk. So, Senator Beyer, did you have any comments?
No, Madam Chair.
This? Okay. Senator Beyer, we have the Dash 3 amendments.
Madam Chair, move the Dash 3 amendments into Senate Bill 573.
Senator Beyer has moved the Dash 3 amendments into Senate Bill 573. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer.
Senate Bill 573 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 573 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Okay, my name's on the bill, so I'll carry it.
That would be good.
Yes, thank you. It's a good traffic safety measure, pedestrian safety measure. Okay, Senator Walker, are you ready for a hearing on your bill?
On 629?
695.
Are we doing a work session?
We can either do a work session or a hearing.
Okay.
We're
Senator
all about
Beyer, are you all about my amendments on 629?
I don't know if I've seen your amendments yet on 629.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and open a work session on Senate Bill 629, Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Senate Bill 629 relates to interest on money judgments. ORS 137.183 provides that money judgments in criminal actions accrue interest at the rate of 12.5% annually for the first 5 years from the date the judgment is entered, and then at 4% for each subsequent year. It is presently irrelevant whether a defendant is sentenced to prison. The same rules apply regardless. Senate Bill 629 amends ORS 137.183 to provide that interest does not accrue on any money judgment while the defendant is incarcerated. Once the defendant is released, then the same rules apply, 12.5% for the first 5 years and then 4% for each subsequent year. However, those figures changed in an amendment. Senate Bill 629 applies only to judgments entered after July 1, 2007, which is also the effective date of the Act. And there's a dash one amendment to Senate Bill 629, and what this amendment does, it clarifies a few issues, but one thing, it changes the rate of interest. It changes that rate of interest from 12.5% annually for the first 5 years, and then 4% annually for the remaining time. It changes that to a flat statutory rate of 9%, consistent with many other provisions of Oregon law. It also clarifies that interest does not accrue on a person sentenced to prison until the first day of the second full calendar month following sentencing in which the monetary obligation was imposed. So they're trying to target the specific sentence that the person was incarcerated for there.
Okay, Senator Walker, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, these amendments were worked out with Paul Snyder for Association of Oregon Counties and with Amy Alkanich with Criminal Defense Lawyers. I don't see Amy in the room. There's Paul. Maybe Paul wants to come up and
Mr. Snyder, come on up and opine on these amendments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. And we had a couple of issues. One is how to reconcile this bill with House Bill 2311, which just passed the House floor. And I think the conflict issue will be resolved. And we very much appreciate Senator Walker's work in accommodating our other concern, and that had to do with at what point the interest begins to accrue. And the issue that we had was, if somebody's in, somebody's out, how do you know whether the person's in, how do you know whether the person's out, how do you know whether or not you have a valid judgment with the right dollar figure? And I think Senator Walker's proposed amendments correct that issue by providing the initial term of incarceration is the one that suspends the accumulation of the interest. So we're fine with the amendments and appreciate the help Senator Walker gave us.
Okay.
And Senator Cruz was fine with the bill, though he's not here.
Okay. Senator Beyer has his ORS out. So, Senator Beyer, did you have any comments on this?
Madam Chair, I was just looking to see, because it doesn't say 9% of the bill. It says provided in 82.010 in the amendment, and I was just looking to see what 82.010 said. And if you want it to be 9%, why doesn't it say 9%? Why are we tying it to the statute?
Because it changes, Senator Beyer. It'll change. The statutory rate of interest can change. Isn't that correct, Mr. Snyder?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, Senator Beyer, that I think is to deal with the conflict with House Bill 2311, which may be the change. So whatever the statute is, when the dust settles with the Legislative Assembly, is what will control.
That's right. That's right, because there's a House bill over there that was going to impact this. Remember, there was some discussion about that the two might conflict.
So the House bill is changing 82010?
That's how I understand it.
Yeah. I believe it is.
To what?
9%.
It is 9% now.
I don't know.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I think what it gets complicated. That the problem is that there are a number of courts, pretty much all courts, that cannot do the interest rate calculation and posting, and that's what House Bill 2311 deals with. And it gets complicated because it says that with respect to interest that would accrue to a victim, it's going to go to the crime victim's account. Otherwise, the decision as to at what point that begins to accrue comes. when the Oregon Judicial Information System has the capacity to do all the calculations for circuit court judgments. It's a complicated bill.
To your knowledge, does the House bill change the interest rate?
It does. It changes whether or not it's going to accrue, and I believe it does change the rate, Madam Chair.
But if we see that bill and we don't like it, this bill basically would maintain the 9%.
Correct.
Yes, whatever. I think that's why it was written in this bill the way it's written,
okay.
So that if you don't like the change the other bill makes, this bill won't have to be amended again later.
Right. Okay. So yeah. I guess then the question would be, is there any policy reason for having a different interest rate for this purpose than for other purposes under 82.010?
That's a good question, and I guess the statute in the past has had a different interest rate than 82.010,
mm-hmm.
And so the policy decision is, you know, was the 12% for the first 5 years and 4% after that. Where did those numbers come from? I have no idea.
I don't either, but to me it's six of one, half dozen of the other, because it sort of averages out to be your 9%.
Madam Chair, if I may, that bill has passed the House floor and it's coming over here. It deals with a number of issues that are complex and important. And I'm just hopeful that you'll stay with the amendment that provides whatever the statute says it's going to be when the legislature is completed. The amendment, the way it's written now in this bill, I think covers that issue and allows you to make that policy choice later when you hear all the issues that, and there are quite a few.
Okay, so basically this would set a flat interest rate of some sort rather than this variable rate. A flat interest rate, but would only apply to periods in which the person was not incarcerated.
Madam Chair, I think it would, it just makes reference to the statute that says what the interest rate is. So whatever that statute says is what interest will apply in the Senate bill.
Okay.
But Madam Chair, this is, that's fine. I'm not going to be concerned about that. But what you just said, I make sure that you said as long as the person is not incarcerated, but I think it says as long as the person is not incarcerated for the original sentencing.
Right.
So if they go back into jail or prison, the interest continues to compound.
That was the issue,
yes,
that we addressed with the Association of Oregon Counties, because they had, you know, sometimes these people go in and out, and we can't keep track of that. That would have been a reporting nightmare.
Good. I'm glad you pointed that out.
Okay.
Yeah. That was right. What I was willing to deal on.
And I guess I'd also just clarify that as of today, with this amendment, the interest rate is 9% and it's fixed.
Mm-hmm.
If 82.010 changes to 9% one day and 12% the next and 18%, then 0%, it will be this interest rate will be whatever 82.010 says, not 9%.
Correct. It's highly unlikely it would ever be 18%, though the statutory judgment rates always kept at a lower level. It kind of follows the federal rate, doesn't it, Mr. Snyder? Isn't the statutory?
I'm sure, Senator Walker, no, I think it's designated by law in Oregon.
Okay.
So, Senator Beyer, how do you feel
Madam
comfortable?
Chair, you move the dash one amendment into Senate Bill 629.
Senator Beyer has moved the dash one amendment into Senate Bill 629. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 629 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 629 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Any discussion? Any objection?
Just thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. So ordered. You can carry it, Senator Walker.
Okay.
And, I should have said this at the beginning, but if anybody in the room is here for Senate Bill 694, we are not going to take that bill up today. We'll reschedule that. My apologies for not making that clear at the very beginning.
Is that the pregnant pig bill?
You got it. We have so many interesting issues in Senate Judiciary. Okay. Now, should we do next?
Yeah.
Let's do your 695.
Okay.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 695. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Senate Bill 695 relates to attempts to locate missing persons. Recently, there have been multiple news incidents involving attempts by law enforcement or search and rescue operations to locate missing persons through cell phone signals. Examples include climbers on Mount Hood and the James Kim tragedy and others. Senate Bill 695 requires that if there is an imminent threat of death or serious bodily injury to someone, then any person who provides cellular communication or wireless services for the missing person must provide any and all information relating to the location of a cell phone or other wireless device if requested to do so by a law enforcement officer. It would this provision would be placed into ORS Chapter 759, which generally relates to telecommunications utility regulation.
Okay, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Mr. Stanford did a good job as always. And while those two cases...
Your name for the record.
Oh, yeah, Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. Darn, I hate it when I forget that. While those two cases that the council cited are relevant, those are not why I drafted the bill. Though I gave thought to that when, especially in the Kim case, but the reason I drafted the bill is because a very dear friend that I went to high school with called me in a panic one night, in a big panic, because one of her friends was suicidal and could not be located. She kept calling her family. She kept calling her friend. She kept calling everyone else, but no one could locate her, and they were in a panic because they were confident this woman was going to take her life. And so she called me and said, isn't there something you can do as a state senator to make the police help me find my friend? And the answer was no. There's nothing I can do because cell phone companies aren't required to tell you where this woman is. And she was calling all the time on the cell phone. They contacted the police, but the police weren't all that helpful either. And so my advice to my friend and the family was to keep talking, keep this person on the phone as long as possible and keep talking, keep her awake, because we didn't know if she had yet taken any pills or anything like that. She did come home safely a couple of days later, but it made me realize that we needed to talk about this, and cell phone companies should be able to provide that information to people in an emergency situation. I think about children who are kidnapped or anything like that, maybe kidnapped by a parent. They're afraid to call the police. It doesn't matter. There are several situations, and I understand that sometimes when we pass these bills, there are unintended consequences, and I know the ASLU is going to point out one of those, and I'll listen to it. I'm totally open. I must have a reputation in the Capitol, though, because people were afraid to talk to me about their concerns. But I don't mind that we have a conversation about this. I just think that we need to think about it and what we can do for other situations like this, because it would have weighed heavily on my conscience had this young woman actually taken her life and there was nothing that I could do about it. So that's the simple story of how this bill came into being. And I'm very interested, Madam Chair, in listening to the people who are here to testify.
Thank you, Senator Walker. Senator Beyer, do you have any questions for Senator Walker?
No, not now. Thanks.
Okie dokie. We will now ask Dan Humans. I think I pronounced your name right.
Close.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Senator or Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Dan Yeomans. I'm with Singular Wireless, and I also represent AT&T. Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify in favor of Senate Bill 695. We actually enjoy a very good working relationship with the law enforcement agencies across the United States when they come to us and request information. We fully understand the role that our technology can play in helping to locate people and save lives. I can tell you that literally we receive hundreds of requests every year from various law enforcement agencies looking for help, and we do everything we can to cooperate with them. In fact, we've set up a process for them to request information from us. It's a very easy, simple process, and probably more importantly, timely process in terms of providing information to them. At the same time, the process takes into account protecting people's privacy, which is another high priority for our company. We think right now we already meet the intent of this legislation, but we also support the bill. However, we would like to suggest two amendments. First, after the word provide in the bill, which I believe is in the second line, we suggest adding the phrase, if technically feasible. Our feeling is that if we're going to be required by state law to provide this type of information, such as a person's location, we want to make sure that we're not in violation of the law if for some technical reason we are not able to comply. There are limitations with what our network can do, and I would Chair Burdick and Senator Walker like to address your issue specifically after I get done with my testimony, because I think that was a very interesting case that you had. The other suggestion we have for an amendment is to add what we call hold harmless language. In this particular case, we would, if we were acting in good faith, we would not be held liable if some unnecessary types of legal action were taken against us. This type of language is very common in 911 statutes, where we are also, by federal law, required to provide location information to public safety answering points. And we could pattern that language in this bill after that 911 statute language so that they would be consistent. But that would be very important to us. So to get back to your particular situation, one of the limitations that we would have in locating someone like that would be if they did not call 911 and we did not have location technology in place, it would be very difficult to pinpoint their location. We might be able to trace their phone records to the wireless cell site that they connected to, but that would only give us a broad geographic area in which to search for that person. Now, again, if they called 911 and we had location technology in place, and I can tell you in Oregon, we don't have that in place everywhere yet, it would be very difficult to pinpoint that person. So again, as much as we try to cooperate and provide as much information as we can, there are limitations to what our technology can do. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
To get a read off of a cell phone tower, what do you need? Does the phone just need to be on, or does somebody need to be actively talking?
We can. Well, what we can do is trace the person's phone records to see where they made their last call. And that's typically the best way to try to find someone, because there will be a pattern, especially if they are moving, and their connection will be transferred from cell site to cell site. And so if we can go to the last one where they made a call, that would give us our best option. But for our network, it really doesn't really matter if their phone is on or not. It's really where they made their last connection. Now, other cell phone companies have other types of technology in which they're able to actually, what they call, ping a phone, which will help them get their current location. And I know our company is working toward that technology, but not everyone has that yet. But again, it would just limit you in terms of their location to that particular cell site or the geography covered by that cell site.
In the ping situation?
Right.
And Madam Chair, could I ask how large an area are we talking about? Excuse me, because it's likely she was holed up in a, well, she was holed up in a motel. So are we talking a 10-mile square area, or, I mean, how is that broken down generally?
Chair Burdick and Senator Walker, the way it works is each cell site is divided into what are called three sectors.
Okay.
And if you notice, if you ever look up a cell phone tower, you'll see a triangular shape platform up there with antennas attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
That represents the three different sectors, which are like big pieces of pie, that particular area covers for that cell site. And in terms of the actual geography, it really depends on what that cell site has been assigned to cover. In an urban area like a city, that could be as small as a quarter of a mile. In a rural area, a cell site can cover up to 20 miles. And so it can be a very broad area. So it really depends on the location.
Does the tracing, does that determine which of the three angles the person is in?
Yes, correct.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. Senator Barr, do you have any other questions?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess under this language, not as you suggest, but as drafted, it seems like if they must provide all information relating to the location of available or in the location of the telephone communication device, I mean, that could conceivably, you could have to go out and physically set up new equipment to try to find a person. That's not
how we would read the bill. If it would be all information, I guess we would read it as currently available to us, that we would currently have the capacity to provide, that we would not be required to create some kind of new technology in order to address that particular request.
Well,
I think that covers your amendment. Suggested amendment too, to be if technically.
Well, that's feasible. If you include an amendment, but I'm saying right. Drafted, when it doesn't say that, it just says all information available. I mean, that's pretty
right.
Broad.
You'd have to have their amendment.
Yes. And Chair Burdick and Senator Walker, that's actually one reason we want to include that particular amendment is to make sure that we're not being required to do something beyond what we are currently capable of doing.
Madam Chair, in this particular case, there was a report made to the police, and then they called the cell phone company. The cell phone company wouldn't do anything until the police did anything, and the police wouldn't do anything until she was missing for 24 hours. She was suicidal. She could have been dead in 24 hours. So that was a conundrum for this family as well.
And Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, typically what we require, and again, because we have to balance these types of requests with protections of people's privacy,
right.
Typically what we require is a subpoena from the police to us so that we can verify that this is a legitimate request being made by a legitimate law enforcement agency. There are cases in which it's a dire emergency, it's a life-threatening situation, and the police need that information immediately, and that's what we call an exigent circumstance. And in that case, what we will do is immediately fax a form to the police agency. They fill out the form, they fax it back to us. That gives us the verification that it's a legitimate request, and then we provide whatever information we have available. So you do not have to go through the whole subpoena process.
Okay.
And are you available to provide this information 24/7?
Yes, our center, we have what's called our National Compliance Center, is located in Florida, and it's available 24/7. And again, it literally receives hundreds of requests every year for information, and we try to comply as best we can to every one of them.
Okay, thank you. Mm. Any other questions?
Mm,
okay. Thank you. Dave Fedenke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, David Fedenke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon, also urging amendments to this bill, although we don't have a complete solution to the concerns that we have, and I appreciate Senator Walker's always being willing to listen to concerns, and my apologies, we just weren't able to get to you sooner. Our concern is primarily that we would like to see some sort of court order required, or at least court supervision after the fact in exigent circumstances. Cellular technology has been moving so quickly that before very long, every cell phone that is carried by an individual may be capable of sending out a GPS signal that will specifically locate that individual. And we're very concerned about law enforcement being given broad authorization to be able to locate an individual without some gatekeeper for their use of that authority. In the language of this bill, we're somewhat comforted by the use of the word imminent threat of death or serious bodily injury. But in the context of some of the enforcement efforts we've seen at the federal level, in relating to preventing future acts of terrorism, including the warrantless wiretapping engaged in by the National Security Agency, and a program that has been rumored to be an NSA program, but and reported about in the media, but which has not been confirmed by the White House or any other federal officials. The NSA reportedly has gained access to the long-distance telephone call records of millions of Americans and has created a massive database of long-distance phone calls. We don't know if the NSA, number one, we don't know for sure if that program exists. We believe it does. We don't know under what authority the NSA might have operated, but one possible authorization would be the national security letter provision of the Patriot Act, which has been expanded since the original adoption of the Patriot Act. And that is a provision that you may recall just in the last couple of weeks. The Federal Department of Justice Inspector General reported that the FBI has abused that legislative authority and has gone way beyond what was contemplated in the statute. So it's in that framework that this bill makes us quite nervous. If law enforcement can get access to the location of an individual without any oversight by the judicial branch or even any reporting after the fact to the judicial branch or anyone else about access to these kinds of records they may have obtained under the authority of this legislation. So what we would like to see is, number one, there are procedures under current law to obtain telephonic search warrants from the courts to get access to information like this that can be very quick. It's also possible for law enforcement to fax an affidavit to a judge rather than appearing before the judge in person. And so we'd either like to see the bill use that process or some other process that would allow judicial oversight either prior to this information being obtained or shortly thereafter. Does that make sense, Madam Chair and Senator?
I hear what you're saying. I don't know that that's the only way to address your concerns, but
there may be many ways to address our concern, and we'd
in
be very interested.
In this building, there are many ways to do things. Trust me.
And we'd be very interested in working with Senator Walker and other interested parties.
Okay. Well, I think that would be a good idea, Senator Walker, if you can just kind of. And it might be by putting some sideboards on the circumstances that somebody can use it if it's imminent, because the cell phone people are not going to want to be acting in bad faith, certainly. So,
right.
Madam Chair, I'm a little surprised. I know there are more carriers than singular. I'm assuming by their non-appearance at the dais that they must like the bill. I'm not sure. I see Verizon out there,
and there's
T-Mobile, and no one's come to me to complain about it.
Their hands went up, their smiles are on their face.
So I can't work on a bill if I don't know the problem.
Okay, well, I'm going to close this public hearing now. Thank you. And Senator Walker, you can work with Mr. Fudanky, and anybody who doesn't work with Senator Walker will just have to live with the result.
So there you go.
Now we're going to try to do the world's fastest work session on Senate Bill 266. Open the work session. Council.
Thank you, Chair Bardick, members of the committee. Senate Bill 266 relates to the Governor's Commission on the Law Enforcement Medal of Honor, which I'll refer to as the Commission. The Commission establishes rules for and nominates candidates for the Law Enforcement Medal of Honor. It presently consists of 5 members who are representatives of the following: the Governor's Office, the Department of Public Safety, Standards and Training, Oregon Chief of Police, Oregon Sheriff's Association, and a representative from a statewide police officer organization. Senate Bill 266 adds a sixth member, and it says, it states that it will be a representative from a statewide organization of peace officers. The motivation behind the bill, as my understanding, is to add a representative from the other main statewide police organization. This bill previously had a public hearing, and you may recall that there were questions about why not state specifically what entities we want representatives from within the statute. My understanding from speaking with legislative counsel is that unless those bodies are themselves statutorily created, they don't like to refer to them specifically in the statute. And if I've misstated anything, Kate Toswell is here from legislative counsel and can address those concerns.
Okay, we had a hearing on it, and we had a representative of management coming up to testify in favor of having represented members on the organization, so it looks like we had consensus, and I'm kind of wondering why we didn't do it at the time, but we have no amendments, right?
There are no amendments, but an amendment request was submitted, Chair Burdick, saying, can you please, rather than say one member shall be a representative of a statewide organization of police officers and one member shall be a representative of a statewide organization of peace officers, rather than saying that, can't we just say we want a representative from X and Y and name the specific entities? And the response from legislative counsel was those entities are not statutorily created, therefore that would be an inappropriate thing to do, and therefore there is no amendment.
Okay. Anybody have concerns? We have Mr. Delashmet back there lurking in case he's needed. Okay. Senator Beyer, are you okay with this?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 266 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 266 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
And I hope this improved your day, Mr. Delashmet. Thank you. And our last item today is a public hearing on Senate Bill 108. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. Senate Bill 108 relates to the traffic infraction of following too closely. ORS 811.485 defines the Class B traffic offense of following too closely. Presently, a driver commits this infraction in any one of the following ways. One, following a vehicle more closely than is reasonable given speed, traffic, and road conditions. Two, little bit complicated, but driving a truck, bus, or vehicle towing something behind a different truck, bus, or vehicle towing something without leaving sufficient space for a passing car to enter the space between the vehicles safely. Did I state that correctly?
Sounds good to me.
Thank you. And then the third traffic classification is essentially the same one as number two, but substitute caravan or motorcade other than a funeral procession. Same deal. What Senate Bill 108 does is it adds a fourth category to the offense of following too closely. And that category is this: driving a vehicle so as to come up behind another vehicle in an unsafe manner. It then also makes following too closely a Class A violation as opposed to a Class B violation, which it typically is. It becomes a Class A violation any time that following too closely actually results in a collision.
Okay, we have signed up Michael Steffel. Topical? He'll tell us. Welcome. We're not really deserting you. It's just people have, this was a bad day, but we still wanted to hear you tell.
I understand. Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Michael Steffel, and I'm a sergeant with the Oregon State Police. I'm assigned to the Patrol Services Division and General Headquarters here in Salem. I serve as a program manager for several different traffic safety-related programs. One of the programs that I manage is collision reconstruction. In my 22-plus year career with the Oregon State Police, I've either personally investigated or assisted in hundreds of collision investigations, from minor property damage to traffic collision homicide investigations. Today, I'm here to discuss our support of Senate Bill 108, which modifies a current statute for following too close, to add the language to cover circumstances of when a motorist fails to stop for a vehicle slowed or stopped in traffic, oftentimes known as rear-end collisions. According to the 2005 crash summary analysis through CARES, there were over 12,000 crashes involving drivers who failed to avoid a stopped vehicle. Conversely, there were only 804 crashes that listed the driver error as falling too close. I submit that many of the 12,000 crashes fall into the categories of drivers who failed to stop for vehicles slowed or stopped in traffic. Currently, the only statute that addresses this type of driver behavior is careless driving. However, there is a connotation associated with the word careless that is often perceived negatively on a person's character. There are times when driving behavior is careless in nature, and citations issued charging this violation encompass several hazardous violations being committed at about the same time or in sequence. This bill will amend the current language in the following too closely statute by addressing the negligent driving behavior of motorists who fail to stop for a slowed or stopped vehicle in traffic. The proposed language addresses this situation specifically and is a remedy that the Oregon State Police supports. I thank you for allowing me to testify today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. So you're mainly aimed at places where situations where a collision actually occurs. Or are you talking about near misses, too?
Madam Chair, we're talking about both when crashes occur and when there are near misses. The other circumstance that I would add into that is oftentimes happens on the freeway, the interstate system, where a person driving the posted speed is then overtaken by a high-speed vehicle. That high-speed vehicle crowds that car by only a few feet and then backs off immediately. And that would also constitute an unsafe coming up behind a vehicle in an unsafe manner.
Well, there's two sides to that story. It's one thing if they're in the slow lane, but it's another thing if they're poking along in the passing lanes. Do you agree?
Madam Chair, the one thing that I would say is that even I driving a police vehicle, it's a marked Chevrolet Tahoe, so it doesn't look like a traditional police vehicle. I have had that happen to me on the interstate. And I tend to drive at just above the posted speed so that I don't hold up traffic. And I've had this happen to me where people just didn't recognize, even though it says Oregon State Police across the back, and they just don't recognize it.
Are you in the passing lane when
actually,
that
yes. And actually, at one time, Madam Chair, it was during a snow-related time. So
I've just been advised by my lawyer not to incriminate myself. Okay, so it is a different matter when you've got somebody on the interstate, somebody in the regular lanes versus somebody in the slow lane. I mean, I think it's a different set of facts isn't it true that if you have more than two lanes, the third one is supposed to be a passing lane?
Yeah, Madam Chair, actually you are required to drive to the right unless you're passing.
So many people don't know that.
So maybe we could put an amendment in here that would only make this apply in cases where the other car is obeying the law, that particular law.
Madam Chair, I think the way that the bill is crafted currently, it covers many of the scenarios. I think also that because our troopers and other police officers are given discretion as to when to apply this statute, I think you're going to see that it is mainly applied to those situations where a vehicle fails to stop for a slowed or stopped vehicle in traffic, a rear-end collision. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, it's been very frustrating over the many years that I've done this, to have basically no charge or no really good charge to hold someone accountable for poor driving behavior. And in this particular circumstance, and it has been a request from sergeants on our department and from troopers on our department that feel that careless driving is just simply too harsh. It carries that negative connotation. And it's just too harsh of a statute to apply to that sort of driving behavior, whereas it is a negligent driving behavior, and this statute, as written, would cover that circumstance.
Well,
and that's really the aim of it.
I was just the recent victim of a one of those rear-end collisions. Luckily, I was not the perpetrator. I was the victim where someone, I slowed down in traffic, and the person behind me did not even slow down. And so it can be quite traumatic. But it wasn't in an interstate situation. And so this would apply everywhere. Do you have any, since we're on this subject, when you talk to your officers about it, do you find a large number of these people who are doing this are on cell phones when they do it?
Chair Burdick, I have no idea on statistics regarding that.
Don't ask
the study shows
you
that the cell phone, the reaction time actually slows down when you're on a cell phone. That you can, you know, you see somebody in front of you and you slow down, but your reaction time is slower.
Madam Chair, I am aware of a study that does show some tremendous reaction times for a perception reaction times for somebody on a cell phone, and whether that be the case of being simply distracted, not paying attention because you're reaching down for a beverage in your car while you're driving, if it results in a negligent behavior of rear-ending another vehicle, this statute, the way that it's written, or this amendment, or this proposal, covers that circumstance.
Okay. Senator Walker, do you have any?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I mean, I have this happen to me all the time because I do so much driving, as you probably do. You know, you'll be in a long line of traffic, and you'll be in the passing lane, and the people behind you are so close that it freaks me out, because if there's any sudden stop up above, I'm going to get rear-ended, and they won't back off, and I can't get over because there's all this traffic. So on occasion, I have stepped on my brake really quick to flash my brake lights at them, and then, of course, they flash their headlights at me. But I don't know if I'm illegal in doing that, but it backs them off. But this bill, I mean, already in law, you could cite someone a ticket for following me like that in that line of traffic because they're following too closely. It's not reasonable and prudent. So the unsafe manner, I guess I need a little more description. That's like somebody whipping up behind you, whipping out, whipping in again because they don't like all the traffic. Is that what you mean by unsafe manner?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker.
So first of all, am I okay by flashing my brake lights at them?
The typical what we call brake check is not legal. You need to apply your brakes. No, to do it.
You're telling me that do not incriminate myself. No.
Thank you, Evans. We have a lawyer with us.
Yeah.
So brake check is not legal?
No, because I mean to do something like that, if somebody's braking in a manner to cause, you know, somebody to cause a crash,
it's to avoid a crash.
Decelerate without having a clear reason to do so, with the intent of trying to do what you're describing, that's the start of road rage, quite frankly.
So how do you get someone off your back?
Continue to drive in a reasonable and prudent manner, and then yield to the right and let them go. That's really the wisdom that I could pass on to you. But to do a brake check is not going to solve the problem. In fact, as you mentioned, it actually worsened it
He backed off. I mean, it happened just recently when I was coming back from Ashland, and he backed off. He flashed his lights at me, but he backed off and gave me some space until I couldn't get over because there were people over here. So anyway, I probably have incriminated myself now. But
is it illegal to flash your lights? You can tell who's who in these scenarios.
Yeah.
Is it illegal to flash your lights?
Flashing, Madam Chair and Senator Walker, if you flash your lights and you use your high beams, then it would be illegal. If you're turning on your lights and turning them off when they're not required, when the lights are not required, then that is okay.
Okay, most people flash the high beams.
They usually flash their high beams, and then that would
and
be
illegal.
And
that's illegal. Okay, this has been very useful. Actually,
we should have had this conversation.
When I'm tailgated, Senator Walker, my policy is, and I usually am in the passing lane for good reason, And my policy is to open up double the space you'd have to be safe. So if the person in front of me stops, I've got double the space to stop so that the bumper crawler behind me will have more space. Is that good driving?
Madam Chair, I applaud that.
Have I redeemed myself now?
I hope so. Because, you know, this is forever in perpetuity, and I'll go to archives, so they're going to come for us in the dark of the night and give us our traffic citation.
They have to catch us first, Senator Walker.
Well, anyway, back to the question of unsafe manner. It's just not described in the statute. So is that discretionary with the officer? And then if you object to the ticket, you just go to court and you argue about what was safe and unsafe?
Madam Chair and Senator Walker, that truly is the basis of the system. Is, and I tell people this when I issue a citation, is you're not being found guilty of anything, and here are your options on the back. Mm-hmm. And if you feel truly that you're innocent of this, let's let a third party, a judge, make that decision. And it seems to work.
Yeah.
And that's the salesmanship part of the citation of
the job.
Trying to get that out.
It would be nice to have something more specific in this, because we all know what you're talking about. But, for example, you know, I think the rule of thumb is one car length for every 10 miles an hour that you're supposed to keep between yourself and the other car.
Yeah, Madam Chair, two different ways, the two-second rule or one vehicle length for every 10 miles per hour.
So if you could, like, quantify what you mean, because, you know, we all, it's great to say that you have a chance to argue these tickets, but nobody does. Nobody has that much time or patience in their life to do that. I mean, basically, when it gets right down to it, maybe some people do, but usually you just, like, suck it up and pay the fine. So if you have in an unsafe manner, that can be a matter of great interpretation.
Madam Chair, I would agree, and that's, and that, of course, would be part of the training when this bill passes to the law enforcement community to make sure that they understand what the intent of this is. The only other stat that I would even offer is that in 2005, you know, we talked about the 12,000 fail to stop for a stopped vehicle, which are crash-causing events, and there were only 6,000 falling too close. Crash-causing crashes for the driver behavior. There were only 4,600 falling too close convictions recorded by Department of Motor Vehicles. So this is a very difficult statute to apply. It does take some training for the law enforcement to be able to prove their case. And this would be one of those things that we could revisit this, because it is, I do have a press release that ODOT put out in 2006 that talked about tailgating as the number one crash-causing event in Oregon currently. And that's, I think, what drives this more than anything at this time, is that it is one of the high crash-causing producing driver behaviors, and there's really very little accountability that goes along with it.
Yeah.
I'm just not sure this gets it here. I'm willing to continue the conversation, though. I'm just not quite sure that this particular approach gets us there.
Especially if you, but I, you know, the other part about if you contribute to the collision by doing that, I really like that piece.
Well, that's true, but I mean, if you ever go through the Terwilliger curves when you're doing absolutely everything right, and because I believe me, that's one place where, you know, no distractions, no nothing. It's probably the most dangerous part of the freeway. Doing everything right, leaving plenty of room. I've almost rear-ended several times because the traffic just all of a sudden just comes to a dead halt.
You need both hands on the wheel going through those curves.
Yep. Good night's sleep the night before. everything going for you. Good lunch.
Okay. Well, okay. So...
Okay, well, let's close the public hearing now, and why don't we can continue the conversation and maybe bring this back. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 108, and that completes our agenda. We are adjourned.
Well, now that we're off.